Icatra Foundation presents the Icatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Icatra AI. Welcome back. Today, we're diving deep, really deep, into, well, an American icon, Samuel Langhorne Clemens, the man we all know as Mark Twain.
And we're using Ron Chernow's fantastic biography as our guide. It's really about getting past the famous white suit and the easy humor.
Right, digging into the man himself. And Chernow gives us this amazing hook right at the start, Twain's own prediction about Halley's Comet.
Oh, yeah, that he came in with it in 1835 and said he'd go out with it, too.
And he did, 1910, just as the comet returned. It's almost too perfect, isn't it? And sort of encapsulates this life lived at the extremes. Success, grief, cosmic timing. Okay, so let's unpack that life.
Exactly. And that prediction, it kind of frames our mission here, which is to separate Samuel Clemens, the complex, often tormented man, from Mark Twain, the public figure, the legend.
How did the guy who gave us Tom Sawyer, this like symbol of American optimism, end up so dark, so pessimistic?
Well, that's the core question, isn't it? Chernow reveals this incredible tension. He was apparently a very loving family man, but also prone to these, well, volcanic rages and a fierce critic of Gilded Age greed, the whole money-grabbing culture.
But he desperately wanted to be rich himself.
Desperately. Chasing one scheme after another. And then there's the iconoclast, the guy who poked fun at everything.
Yeah.
Who also really, really craved approval from the fancy Eastern establishment. It's just full of these contradictions.
Okay, let's start at the beginning then. Hannibal, Missouri, the famous St. Petersburg.
Right, born 1835, raised in Hannibal. And Chernow makes a key point. It wasn't just Tom Sawyer's playground. This was antebellum Missouri.
Meaning slavery.
Meaning slavery, yeah. And casual violence. It was just part of the background. His own family owned slaves. It was a border state reality.
So that idyllic boyhood image, it's got this really dark underside.
Absolutely. And that moral complexity, that tension, it's something he wrestled with his whole life, even if it took a long time to really surface in his work.
It sounds like he had to kind of unlearn his upbringing.
A lot of it, yes. And alongside that moral ambiguity, there was this constant shadow of, well, money problems. His father, not so great with finances.
Yeah. The book mentions repeated failures.
And his father died young, which forced Sam Clemens out of school at, what, age 12?
12. To become a printer's apprentice. That must have been tough.
It definitely instilled what Chernow calls a lifelong terror of poverty. That fear really drove him.
So his formal schooling basically stopped there.
Pretty much. But then came the Mississippi River. That was his real education, his graduate school in democracy, as he called it.
He became a steamboat pilot.
Yep, at 22. Learned under Horace Bixby. Apparently, learning to read the river, all its currents, snags, moods, was incredibly complex.
Wow.
And that skill, that intense observation, it translated directly into how he read people, how he saw society.
And that's where the name came from, right? Mark Twain?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mark Twain, the leadsman's call for 2 fathoms, safe water. Perfect, really.
But then the Civil War shut down the river traffic. End of that career.
Yeah, pushed him west. He tried silver mining in Nevada bust. Then fell into newspaper work, Virginia City.
And that's where he found his voice, that funny, fast, sort of slangy style.
That's where he honed it, leading eventually to the big breakthrough, the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County in 1865.
Ah, the Jumping Frog. Classic.
But the real anchor, personally and maybe professionally too, came in 1870, his marriage to Olivia Langdon. Livy.
She came from a very different background, right? Mm-hmm. Wealthy, refined, Eastern establishment.
Totally different. And she became his, well, his anchor, his muse, but also his editor in a way. She represented the respectability he kind of craved.
Helped him transition from this rough Western humorist to, well, Mark Twain, the major literary figure.
Precisely. And the Hartford years followed, building that incredible, unique house.
The one with the billiard room on top.
That's the one. And writing his masterpieces, especially Adventures of Huckleberry Finn in 1884.
Which Chernow calls, what was it? The book that best captures the moral complexity of American democracy. High praise.
It really is. But here's the other side of the coin. While writing these enduring classics,
he was throwing money away.
He was becoming, as Chernow puts it, a truly undisciplined entrepreneur, pouring vast sums seriously, huge amounts in today's money into one doomed invention or business scheme after another. Still driven by that fear of poverty, ironically.
It's like he couldn't handle success. Or maybe he just kept chasing more success.
It seems like it.
Right?
Which leads us to the big crash.
The page compositor. The typesetting machine.
And that was the main culprit. An obsession. Incredibly complex machine. Maybe brilliant in theory, but a total financial black hole. He sank something like $300,000 into it.
Which is an astronomical sum back then.
Absolutely devastating. It led straight to bankruptcy in the 1890s. Complete financial ruin.
But then he did something pretty amazing, didn't he?
He really did. His lawyers basically said, look, you're legally protected. You don't have to pay all these creditors.
But he refused that advice.
He famously said, honor is a harder master than the law. And he committed to paying back every single cent.
How?
A grueling, year-long, worldwide lecture tour, can you imagine, at his age, already famous, having to basically go hat in hand around the globe.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have taken incredible resolve.
It did, and it actually cemented his reputation for integrity. People were amazed. But right after this public triumph, private tragedy struck.
This is the really hard part.
Yeah. While he was still abroad on that tour, his favorite daughter, Susie, died suddenly back home. Meningitis. 1896.
He wasn't even there.
He wasn't there. It shattered him. Absolutely shattered his optimism. And the losses just kept coming. Livy died in 1904. Then his daughter Jean in 1909.
Oh, man.
He called his later home the House of Mourning. And his writing turned much, much darker. More pessimistic.
So if you connect all these dots,
yeah.
The highs, the lows, the writing, the business disasters, what was driving him underneath it all?
Well, if you look at his core philosophy, especially as it evolved, it starts with this almost allergic reaction to hypocrisy, to cant, to pretense.
He hated phonies.
Hated them. He went from being a humorist making fun of manners to what Chernow calls a raging prophet, denouncing injustice, greed, imperialism.
But that later philosophy got really bleak, didn't it? Deterministic.
Very bleak. He started arguing that humans are just machines, that we have no real free will. We're just products of our circumstances, our training.
He called us the damned human race.
He did. Believed we were just sort of programmed, which makes you wonder.
Yeah, if everything's predetermined and we're all just machines, why get so outraged? Why fight against injustice if it's all inevitable anyway?
That's the great paradox of Twain, isn't it? Intellectually, he might have believed in determinism, but emotionally, morally, he couldn't help himself. His conscience demanded that outrage.
So the feeling trumped the theory.
I think so. His motivations were always kind of in conflict. You had, one, this desperate need for financial security, for respectability, stemming from his father's failures. Two, this deep, almost needy craving for approval, especially from Livy, from the Eastern elite, which sometimes clashed with his own raw Western voice, right?
Right, that tension between being authentic and being accepted.
Exactly. And third, this powerful, evolving moral compass. It really came alive in his later years. It fueled his passionate anti-imperialism. He slammed the U.S. and the Philippines, King Leopold in the Congo.
Which couldn't have been popular sometimes.
Often wasn't. And his support for civil rights, too. He was way ahead of his time on some of that. And it definitely carried personal risk.
It sounds like his life wasn't just a straight line, but full of these sharp turns. Can we pinpoint moments that really changed everything for him?
Oh, absolutely. Chernow highlights a few. I think we can boil it down to three huge turning points.
Okay, what's the first?
The first, and maybe the deepest trauma, was the death of his younger brother, Henry, back in 1858.
How did that happen?
It's a steamboat explosion, the Pennsylvania, and Sam Clemens. He had gotten Henry the job on that boat. He carried this immense, crushing guilt for the rest of his life. Felt totally responsible.
I can only imagine. How did that change him?
It just shattered his youthful optimism. Introduced this deep vein of fatalism, of randomness, of good intentions leading to disaster. You see it everywhere in his later, greater works. That sense of inescapable consequence.
Okay, that's huge. What's the second turning point?
His marriage to Livy Langdon in 1870. We touched on this.
Right. She brought stability, respectability.
Exactly. Emotional stability he clearly needed and the social acceptance he craved. She really helped him make that leap from, you know, the rough-edged humorist to a major literary artist.
But was there a downside? Did she sort of tame him too much, edit out the good stuff?
That's the debate, right? She definitely acted as an editor. She'd review his manuscripts, sometimes tone down things she thought were too coarse or irreverent. But Chernow argues this tension was actually productive. Her influence forced him to refine his art, to find more subtle ways to make his points, which maybe made the satire even stronger in the long run. It wasn't just censorship. It was a creative partnership, even with its constraints.
Interesting way to look at it.
Okay.
And the third pivot.
The bankruptcy decision in 1894, facing ruin from the Page compositor disaster.
We talked about how he chose to pay everyone back.
Right, when he could have legally walked away. That choice, that public declaration of honor over law, and then following through with that incredibly difficult world tour, it was definitive.
How so?
It redeemed him in the public eye, maybe even in his own. It proved that the persona, Mark Twain, was backed by a man, Samuel Clemens, of real substance and integrity, even when facing utter humiliation. It fundamentally shifted how people saw him.
So, looking at this whole sweep of a life, the contradictions, the tragedies, the triumphs, what does it teach us? What can we, you know, take away from it today?
That's a great question. I mean, one big thing is about facing adversity, right? His ability to take financial ruin, public embarrassment, crushing personal loss like Susie's death,
yeah,
and transform it, not just survive it, but turn it into art that still speaks to us about grief, about resilience. Hardship became his raw material.
And humor was key to that, wasn't it?
Absolutely essential.
Yeah.
It was his shield, his coping mechanism for the personal pain, but it was also his weapon for social critique. Remember his famous line, "Against the assault of laughter, nothing can stand."
Oh, yeah.
He used humor to deal with his own demons while simultaneously attacking the world's follies.
There's also that moral journey you mentioned, from growing up accepting the norms of slaveholding Missouri to becoming this fierce, outspoken critic of racism and imperialism later in life. It shows that, well, moral understanding isn't fixed. It's a process. It takes work. It takes questioning your own background, your own culture. It's not easy, but it's possible. That feels very relevant. Now, if we had to distill this incredibly complex life down for you, the listener, what are the absolute core takeaways? Let's try for three.
Okay. Let's start with an emotional insight. For me, it's his profound resilience, but specifically how he channeled grief. His power to take unimaginable personal loss, losing Susie, Livy, Jean, and transform that sorrow not just into dark writing, but into art that connects with the universal human experience of loss and the struggle to find meaning afterwards. Suffering into contribution.
That's powerful. Okay, an intellectual insight. What's the big idea legacy?
Intellectually, it has to be his liberation of American literature through the American vernacular. He proved definitively that you didn't need formal, high-flown European-style language to tackle the biggest themes. You could use the everyday colloquial speech of ordinary people, riverboat pilots, miners, kids on the frontier to offer profound social commentary and moral critique. He made American English respectable in literature.
He gave America its own literary voice.
Right.
Get it. And finally, a universal insight, something practical we can all learn from.
I think it centers on character and integrity embodied by that bankruptcy decision. Choosing honor when the law offered an escape route. That grueling tour wasn't just about money. It was a public performance of character. And connect that to his later adoption of the white suit.
Ah, yes, the iconic white suit.
It wasn't just vanity. It was conscious branding, yes, but also a statement, a deliberate choice to stand out, to be visible, maybe even defiant against what he saw as a dark and dismal world. It tells us that integrity, character, it's something you actively choose and embody, sometimes very publicly. And maybe one final thought to leave you with. Twain was arguably America's first truly modern self-created celebrity. He mastered the soundbite, the public image, the branding, long before we had the language for it.
At a 19th century influencer?
Kind of. And his lifelong struggle to manage that public persona, Mark Twain, while dealing with the anxieties and grief of the private man, Samuel Clemens. Well, that tension between public identity and private authenticity, it feels incredibly relevant today, doesn't it? In our own age of social media and curated lives.
Absolutely. A struggle that still resonates. What a life, what a mind. You really get the sense of the contradictory, brilliant, and deeply American soul in his words. We definitely encourage you to explore his work. Maybe start with Life on the Mississippi for the Joy, and then read some of those later darker essays to hear that prophetic rage. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.